everybody. The House State Affairs Committee will please come to order with us this morning. So far, I think we'll have a full crew here momentarily, but we have Representative Peterson, Representative Seaton, Vice Chair Keller, myself, Bob Lynn. We have four items on the agenda this morning: SCR 17, Girl Scout 100th Anniversary, HB 355, regarding APOC, Public Officers Commission Membership, SCR 19, Reclaiming United States Marshal Day, and SB 104, Manufactured Homes and Real Property. And we're going to start off with the Girl Scout resolution. That's a CS for concurrent resolution number number 17. And Representative Keller.
Yeah. It's been my pleasure to move LS 1140, Bravo, SCE. That's a CS for SCR 17. I would like to say, with a zero fiscal note and individual recommendations, I would like to say there's two things I learned in this interesting process. One is parents and girls, scout leaders, moms, families really care about the values of Girl Scouts, and that's the way it ought to be. And the other thing that pleased me was the Girl Scouts of Alaska definitely stick with their own values and have denied any direct relationship or connection with Planned Parenthood. So I was pleased. Thank you.
Very good. I thank you. I thank you for that, and I would confirm those comments. Any other comment? If not, thank you very much for bringing this to us. If anybody wants to put in written testimony, it will be accepted. So,
Mr. Chairman, I'd just like to put myself on the record. Yeah, I'm Senator Betty Davis, and I represent Anchorage District K. And I thank you very much for moving the bill so timely, and thanks for your remarks, Representative Keller.
Thank you very much. And we'll take a short break here while we sign the paperwork. Thank you.
Thank you.
Next on the agenda is CS for Senate Concurrent Resolution Number 17. The state of, oops, wrong one. I just won't leave that bill alone, will I?
355.
Okay, we'll try this one. This will be HB 355 regarding APOC issues. And would you please introduce yourself and give us an overview of what we have here?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for hearing this bill today. I won't read the sponsor statement for you. I will just say, whether you're a doctor, a land surveyor, a hairdresser, a tattoo artist, when you go before the commission that oversees the work that you do, there are people in that occupation that are on that commission. We appoint members to APOC based upon two from the Republican Party, two from the Democratic Party, and then there's another one appointed at large. I was a little perturbed when I saw the list of Democrats being appointed to the open seat. And I said, there's nobody on here that has any experience. There's nobody on here that knows what we do, knows what our
campaign experience,
right, filing our, not doing the media stuff, not doing the fancy stuff that everybody wants to do, but doing the reporting, the interface with the state agency, the people that have frustrations with how the forms get done, with the electronic filing systems, and have an understanding of what it is with our jobs outside the building, our campaign lives. You know, it's something that people from all walks of life volunteer to do or get paid to do with us, but there should be people on the commission who understand what it is that is they're overseeing. You know, the reporting can be very problematic. I know accountants that won't go near the reporting. They don't understand it. It's not what they do. It's not balancing the books. It's disclosure, which is what it's all about. And this bill, what it does, it just adds to the requirement, and it's on page 2, line 8, extensive experience in the financial the financing of political campaigns in compliance with disclosure and reporting requirements. Now, if you're looking for the definition of those, you'll probably find there's three opportunities for them, that definition, to be vetted. One is in the parties when they decide who they want to put forward. Two, when the governor decides who he's going to appoint to that seat. And three, we have the final decision on whether that person has enough experience for us when we confirm them on the House floor to joint session. And then the rest of the language is about having two non-voting members on as advisors until all the members have been replaced with people with the campaign experience. And that's the gist of the bill.
Thank you very much. And before we go any further, I'd entertain a motion to adopt the CS.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Seaton.
I'd move we adopt CS version I as our working document.
Okay. Without objection, the CS has been adopted. Would you tell us very briefly the difference between this, the CS, and what we had originally?
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chair. It'd be my pleasure. In the original bill, there was a section that I had put in trying to be some ideas that I thought would be good for discussion. What we're taking out is make our APOC disclosures online similar to what the feds do. And that is the online disclosure reporting forms in the federal level are prohibited from being used for building a database. So at the federal level, you can go online and see donations, but you cannot use it to build your own database for campaigning or
any purpose.
Any commercial purpose, right? So that was taken out, and it just focuses on the qualifications of the APOC board.
I think what you have here makes a lot of sense. Everybody at this table has been or is a candidate. And it's really an experience you don't understand until you have been one or you are being one. And I think that perspective needs to be brought to APOC, because it's quite a different thing to discuss and make comments about and make regulations about campaigning. Quite another thing to be those who are or have been candidates. So I think that perspective needs to be there, because it's very interesting. And I think I'd say 99.99% of the people who run for any office anywhere try to do the right thing, try to abide by the law. There are situations that come up, we've all faced them at one time or another, where we want to do what's right. And the APOC rules can be very, very complicated, as we know. Representative Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I was going to ask Representative Guttenberg that this doesn't require someone to have been a candidate. It just says they have to have an experience with disclosure and reporting requirements. So they could have been maybe a volunteer on a campaign or a campaign manager?
Right, correct. Correct. And the point is not to influence the decision-making process, but for us to know that our understandings of what we do come from a similar point, so that when we look back and say, we don't know why they made this decision, but we know at least they have the experience, have made the decision based upon a shared experience.
Thank you. Okay. Representative Grunberg.
Thank you.
By the way, Representative Grunberg, Representative Wilson have joined us.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Some time ago.
Representative Guttenberg, I hadn't put two and two together until just moments ago.
We're related.
I don't know either one of you. Go ahead.
Maybe way back.
Way back.
As you'll remember, APOC came out with a sheet of paper, a memo last week that we talked about on the floor, and I'm due to be talking to the director about that hopefully today. And this is one of two bills in the legislature, in the whole legislature, dealing with APOC. And this bill goes to judiciary next. I just kind of wanted to serve notice that I don't know if we're going to need a legislative fix to that problem, but this could be a vehicle. I'm not going to worry about it today. but I just want you guys to know. And the only other bill is a bill that's basically dead in Senate rules. So this may
never make predictions about what the Senate is going to do.
Well, no, because we passed the subject of the bill, the other one, and we'll talk about this further. Thank you.
You're fine. Anybody else? Anybody online who would like to testify to this bill? Anybody in the room who would like to testify to the bill? If not, I'll entertain a motion.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, Representative Seaton.
Thank you. So, as I understand the bill, under this, there would be 7 members of APOC instead of 5.
Mm-hmm.
But still, there would be 5 voting members, so that the actual decision-making process isn't being changed here. It is just basically getting more expertise onto the commission. Is that correct?
That's correct. And the 2 non-voting members rotate out. I know it's written in legalese, but that's when all the members have campaign experience. The 2 non-voting advisory members are gone. They sit there to help the board. They don't vote.
Reverend Seaton?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just wanted to clarify how the bill worked. Appreciate that.
Thank you.
It's not the intent of the bill to do anything except put more qualifications on the members, not to change the way they do business at all.
Okay. I'll entertain a motion.
I'll move HB 355, version 1388, India, with individual recommendations and 0% salute.
Very good. Any objection? If not, the bill moved from committee. Thank you for bringing it forward.
Thank you, members.
We're taking it at ease. Day. Welcome. Please introduce yourself. You know the drill. And tell us about the bill.
Thank you, Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Chuck Kopp, staff to Senator Fred Dyson. It's my privilege on behalf of our Marshal Service here in Alaska, Senator Dyson, and as a retired law enforcement officer here in Alaska myself, to bring this resolution forward honoring our U.S. Marshal Service and the formative role they played in the history of Alaska, going back from pre-territory, territory, up to the modern day. The Marshal Service was formed as a result of the Judiciary Act of 1789 when the United States Congress appointed the Marshal Service. And shortly after Alaska was purchased from Russia in 1867, we were designated a military district of the United States and placed under control of the War Department. That's why we have a few forts around, including one down in Kenai that Representative Seaton is probably familiar with, cannons and walls still in place. After that, we were briefly under the Treasury and then the Naval Department, and then the Marshals took over in the late 1880s. This was the Wild West then. The Gold Rush was in full force, and we had our first 2 U.S. Marshals were killed in the line of duty right here in Juneau. Marshal William Watt and James Rowan were gunned down right here in this town. Right about the time, I think Wyatt Earp, who is now a retired marshal, was here. Shortly after him, Clyde Calhoun died in the line of duty here, and he was a former marshal in Dodge City, Kansas. Some of you are familiar with the Gunsmoke character, Matt Dillon, whose deep and resonant voice projected a larger life than reality, similar to yours, Mr. Lynn. And he gave us an image of kind of what the marshals were, but up until 1955, they were a prominent role in Alaska's law enforcement history. The territorial legislature formed the territorial police in 1949, but they only had traffic enforcement powers, and that they realized that the crime was just too out of control to not give them criminal enforcement powers as well, so they made them all deputy U.S. Marshals in 1954. And then in 55, the territorial police assumed full police powers. And, of course, in 59, the state territorial police was formed, and a large body of those were former U.S. Marshals. This resolution is brought forward just to proclaim September 24th as a U.S. Marshal Day here in Alaska in honor of their long service. There's recommendations in your packet from our Commissioner of Public Safety, Joe Masters, from the Alaska Peace Officers Association, and from the Alaska Association of Chiefs of Police. Of the first 14 police officers that were killed in the line of duty in Alaska from 1897 to 1955, 8 of those were U.S. Marshals. And they continue today with the Village Crime Reduction Program, which is drug and alcohol interdiction throughout rural Alaska. And with the Sex Offender Registry Identification Compliance Project with the Public Safety, and also with the Badges and Books Program, which is a literacy and a community relationship building project along the Yukon and Kuskokwim River. So they still a very active role today with our Department of Public Safety. Thank you.
Could you, what is the, in brief, the difference in the job between a municipal policeman, a state trooper, and a marshal?
Municipal policeman is a police officer who has primary jurisdiction within the boundaries of their employer, which is the city that has given them the police power, sworn them in to enforce laws in that area. Under the Alaska statutes, they can enforce a criminal law anywhere in the state, but their employer may frown upon that because they're being paid to do the job back at home.
Going
not be busy elsewhere. The troopers are responsible primarily for all unincorporated areas where there is not another prior law enforcement jurisdiction within a municipality. They still supplement that quite a bit where they're needed or requested. And then, of course, the U.S. Marshal Service tends to federal prisoner transport, arrests of federal fugitives who are fleeing from the law. They protect the federal judges, and they also partner particularly in rural law enforcement with the Department of Public Safety and drug and alcohol programs.
Okay. Any questions? Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I didn't even know they still had U.S. Marshals around, so this is very interesting. Tell me, what are your intentions next year? I mean, you only did it for September 24th, 2012, and why not pick a day and every day, every year? I mean,
it was Representative Wilson through the chair. It was the day we were requested, just a one time, once this year, and it's consistent with what other states have done. Oregon did this last year. And some of the other West Coast states have done it recently in the previous few years. They really don't want it every year. It was kind of a one-time state recognition of their service to Alaska. And so we went about it that way. And I think if I was to do it, if we were to do it every year, it would have to come forward in a different manner than it is now. So it's just a one-time, one-day deal in 2012, and that's what we were requested to do.
Follow-up. So you don't intend to do this every year?
No.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah.
Okay, we'll hold you to that next year.
Okay.
Yeah, Representative Grunberg.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I understand we don't have a marshal to testify today. So I'm going to ask you the question, Mr. Cobb.
Yeah.
Last year, for the first time ever, to my knowledge, at the Mountain View, it wasn't the street fair, it was, I think, Night Out Against Crime in the Fall, at Mountain View Boys and Girls Club, where they had a bunch of booths of various people. The marshals had a booth. They'd never had it before. And there were marshals there, and they were wearing their marshal shirts and stuff. And I thought that was really good because nobody, at least in my part of town, hardly, unless they've had personal experience with the marshals, which I won't go into, but has much knowledge about the marshals. And there were both men and women there, and they were having a lot of interface, particularly with the kids in Mountain View. And it happened that Chris Woodward, the principal at Mountain View School, was there, one of the two schools in Mountain View. And I introduced the deputy marshals to Mr. Woodward and suggested that maybe the marshals go into the school and introduce themselves and their program to the children. And when I walked away, they were talking about it. I don't know if that occurred. But I think that kind of thing was great. And I would like to see, and maybe since we don't have the marshals here today, Mr. Cobb, maybe you, if you're interfacing with the marshals, could suggest that would be great for the kids, it'd be great for the marshal service, and maybe, since school will be in session on September 24, of this year, that would be an appropriate day for the marshals to outreach to the schools, and or shortly about that time, and I don't know that you want to have anything in this about that, but I think that would be, this would be a great opportunity for the marshals to interface for the first time with the kids of this state.
Thank you, Representative Grunberg, to the chair. I think it's a great suggestion, and I will follow up on that with the marshals, and I'm sure they would be delighted to do that.
Thank you, and I put down that I'll cross-sponsor your bill.
Thank you.
Okay, Representative Wilson.
I'm just looking, and September 24th is a Monday, so.
Great.
Very good. Anybody else? Anybody else online? Anybody online who'd like to testify? Anybody in the audience who would like to testify? If not, I'll close public testimony. Any comments from the committee? If not, I'll entertain a motion.
I'd be happy to move it. I move, Senate Bill 104. No, I'm wrong one. SCR 19, that's 0919, Mike. Zero fiscal note, independent individual recommendations. I move it from committee.
Thank you. We'll take it at ease while we... Record. Be hearing CS for Senate Bill number 104, Judiciary. Welcome, Senator French.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members of the committee, good morning. For the record, my name is Hollis French. I represent West Anchorage in the State Senate. SB 104, I appreciate you hearing the bill today, is about a simple idea. It lets mobile home owners convert their property, which is now considered something like a motor vehicle, convert it to real property. And it's a way to help these mobile homeowners get lower interest rates and to help them more easily sell their homes when the time comes to do so. The bill was brought to me by the banking industry, and as you can see, it's fairly complex. But at the bottom, it's really a basic idea. You let these folks go through a process that allows them to record their ownership, swear that they've fixed that piece of property to a piece of ground they own, and having gone through the process, they now have something they can mortgage and they can sell more like a regular home. It's important to keep in mind that it's a purely voluntary process. There's nothing that requires people to go through this, something they elect to do, and they can do if they so choose. The heart of the bill really is on page, I think it's on page 14. You'll see that the bill sets out a Manufactured Home Property Act, and it walks through some new sections about how you qualify to have your mobile home.
Today.
I'm sorry?
Let me ask you, today, without this legislation, is it manufactured home personal property or real property?
I think the short answer is personal, although you probably get some different views about that. But my view is it's personal property.
Okay, mostly be personal. And would this convert it to, at the owner's request, from a personal to real property?
Exactly. That's the idea. Yep, that's the idea. There's in the packet, you'll see letters from bankers who point out that we just don't have a good defined process for converting it to real property. And so with the enormous amount of help from Wells Fargo, from local bankers, we've crafted this piece of legislation that walks through the process. You should have online some individuals from Wells Fargo, George Ginsburg, outside counsel, Jeff Harris, one of their loan administration managers, and Patrick Green, all highly knowledgeable about the ins and outs of this process. I guess I would just say that here in Alaska, this bill is supported by Alaska Land Title Association, by First American Title, by Wells Fargo, of course, and then by the Alaska Bankers Association. And that's made up of Alaska Pacific Bank, Denali State Bank, First Bank of Ketchikan, First National Bank of Alaska, Key Bank, Mount McKinley Bank, North Rim Bank, and again Wells Fargo. It's a letter signed by Joe Beadle, and so I think it just comes from good local credentials. I'm happy to answer any questions you or the committee.
Thank you, Ron. I don't think I need to. I am a currently licensed Alaska associate real estate broker. I don't think it poses a conflict of interest, although it could in fact increase the inventory. But I know in that profession, it is notoriously difficult to get financing for any kind of a mobile home, and I've never sold or manufactured home, but I would suppose it would be about the same. Very, very difficult to get financing. Did you pose for a question? Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So if I understand it right, then This doesn't count if in a mobile home park where there's a slab of cement and there's a mobile home sitting on it. But if someone has one and they built a foundation for it and it's affixed permanently, then that becomes a personal property or
real property.
Real property. Okay. Real property.
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, that's exactly right. With the keep in mind, you've got to own the land underneath the trailer. So most mobile home parks, it probably wouldn't work unless you've got a lease for 20 years. The banking industry sees that as, from their perspective, you know, those leases could go, if it's a two-year lease, it could go away. The trailer's got to be moved, and suddenly it doesn't have sort of the indicia of a home. It's more like it's more back to a mobile home. And so the banking industry wants you to own the land underneath it or have a 20-year lease.
Yeah, you're on dangerous territory there, because you're saying mobile home, trailer rather than mobile home.
to the chair, as a former mobile home or trailer house owner, I feel like I have a little bit of leeway. The first home I bought in Alaska was a 1978.
I just wanted to protect you. That's
that's okay. I bought a trailer house that was built in Houston and dragged to Alaska in the pipeline boom, and the walls were, I don't know, they're about the thickness of this laptop computer, I think. And it was a very cold place to live, but I fixed it up and it was mine. And so I have, I was able to sell it and, make a little money on it. Or, you know, if I had to finance it, because you couldn't finance those things. And so, it's a place where a lot of Alaskans start their lives.
I know that on occasion during previous special sessions, I hope it doesn't happen again, but previous special sessions, I've dragged my trailer down here and lived in the trailer and worked out fine. I believe, before I go to have a question here from somebody, he said, is there an age limit on the mobile home slash trailer to qualify under this proposed legislation?
Of the mobile home itself?
Yes.
I don't believe so. I think it's just a, you know, as long as it's permanently affixed to a foundation on land you own, you can convert it to real property. It will be worth, it's just like any home, it'll be worth more if it's newer and less if it's older, but I don't think there's an age limit.
Thank you. Representative Grunberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Do other states have similar laws?
Through the chair, Representative Grunberg, yes, most do. We're just a state that lacks this formal process.
Do you know how many do about?
Through the chair, Representative Grunberg, I do not. I mentioned one of the witnesses
if,
on the
line. If one of the other witnesses could say that, I'd like that on the record. Is there a model act or is there a uniform act? I note that there's a short title to the act, and it's back towards the end of the bill, page 20, lines 22 and 23. So I'm wondering if that was taken from some kind, if the bill was taken from some type of a model act. It's, as I say, Senator, on page 20, lines 22 to 23, or maybe there's an industry standard, which I'd like to put on the record, because that would be persuasive to a court to know in construing this new piece of legislation. Do you happen to know?
Through the chair, Representative Grunberg, the short answer is I do not know. I would turn to one of the industry experts. My guess is no, it's not a model uniform act, but it's also something I think that's similar to many acts in other states.
Okay. If I may continue, Mr. Chair.
Go ahead.
For tax purposes, normally a depreciation of personal property is shorter than a depreciation of real property. And I'm wondering if somebody converts, will that change their depreciation schedule for tax purposes?
Through the chair, Representative Grunberg, this is not an area in which I'm an expert, so
Patrick Green, Wells Fargo, who might be the answer.
Yeah, I don't mean to put you on the spot, but I'm since you're the first one out of the box here.
I don't want
to
guess. Yeah, I'd rather not guess.
Mr. Green, are you there?
Well, Mr. Chair, may I continue? I have another question.
Well, with first grade, yes, we'll go to the next one.
Chairman Lynn, I'm here. Or Wells Fargo, Council might be able to answer a majority of the questions that you pose. I think I'll defer to George if he's on the line.
I am.
Would you identify yourself, please?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Bloomberg, let me answer a few questions.
Would you identify yourself again, sir, and your position?
Sure. My name is George Ginsburg. I'm with the firm of McGlinchey Stafford, and we are outside counsel to Wells Fargo.
Okay. Continue.
The bill itself is not a uniform act in the sense that the Uniform Commercial Code or some other statute which went through the Uniform Conference of Commissioners on Consumer State Laws is, but much of the language is very common. It has been passed or something like it in many other states. I cannot tell you exactly how many, but Senator French is correct in that Alaska is now among the distinct minority of states that doesn't have something like this. And to elaborate briefly on what Senator French said, and then I'll answer the tax question. One of the reasons that people have difficulty getting financing of manufactured homes is that, as you know, these days, of course, the private securitization market and the private secondary market for real estate loans has essentially evaporated, and just about everything now is sold to Fannie Mae or Freddie Mac. Fannie Mae or Freddie Mac requires, as one of its requirements to purchase a real estate loan involving a manufactured home, is that there has to be some state law mechanism that makes clear that a manufactured home permanently affixed to real estate is real estate, in fact, for purposes of state law. That's one of the things that the bill is trying to accomplish. I recognize its length, but the idea at the end of the day is that if this process is concluded the way the bill sets forth, then two things happen. Number one, a manufactured home, which prior to that is most likely personal property, as Senator French said, is converted to real estate. And number two, there is a public record and a consistent public record, both in the real estate recorder's office and in the office of the Division of Motor Vehicles, where either a purchaser or a lender can go and see whether, in fact, the home at that point is personal property or real estate, something that at the moment does not exist in Alaska. Sometimes, frankly, it's hard to tell. You will have homeowners who own a home but don't have the certificate of title, either because they lost it or who knows why, but who are now in the position where they can't sell the home because they have no title. And if the home has already been permanently affixed, they can't get a title because the Division of Motor Vehicles will not issue one to a home that's permanently affixed, nor can they encumber it and use it to get a loan because they don't have a certificate of title to perfect the security interest. And since it's not clearly real estate, it may not be covered by a deed or a mortgage. So what this bill is trying to do, and both in Alaska, I might add, and elsewhere, there is no organized consumer opposition to this bill, despite the fact that Senator French said that it's sponsored by lending institutions, which, of course, is a lightning rod these days. There is no consumer opposition because consumers recognize that it's in their best interests. Now, Representative Groomberg, to answer your question, the bill does not itself expressly address any tax issues. But what it says, in effect, is that once the conversion procedure has been completed, at least until such time as the home is physically removed from the property, and there is a procedure in the bill about severance as well, the home will be considered real estate for all purposes as if it were built from ordinary building materials on site, which means, I assume, I don't know the Alaska tax laws, but I have to assume that from that point forward, whatever tax laws would otherwise apply, I imagine including depreciation, would apply to a home that has been converted to real estate.
Thank you very much. I have
Mr. Chairman,
question that passed me from staff. Said a number of years ago, they purchased a brand new mobile home, and they still had to put a new conforming roof on it to get the property financed in. And the question is, I believe, would the HUD standard eliminate some of the older mobile homes? For example, the older mobile homes may not have the kind of roof of a newer model. Do you have an answer to
that? No, I understand your question. I just want to check the bill. Let me see here.
And if you excuse me, sir, I'm going to have to excuse myself to have a couple of bills up in the Senate, and I'm going to pass the gavel to Representative and Vice Chair Keller at this time. Thank you for your testimony, sir, and everybody. And Representative Keller, you have it.
You're a brave man.
Yeah, and I'm a brave man.
I know that the bill amends the Uniform Commercial Code 2, but I need to see that just one second.
Hmm. That's the UCC.
To be honest with you, I have to check. I think that older manufactured homes may not qualify, in part because people are now concerned about safety standards. Manufactured home for these purposes, I know, is given the meaning as defined in the Uniform Commercial Code, but I don't have that in front of me. What I will do, though, I will check, and then we will get the answer back to whoever you tell me.
Yeah, a little bit of a follow-up on that, George's Representative Keller.
Yes, sir.
I would assume that the liability for the construction would belong to the bank and to the owner, not really indirect to the state. I think that's is that a safe assumption?
Well, I don't know why it would belong to the bank. The home would have to be permanently affixed. If Alaska is like most states, and I don't know off the top of my head, but it would have to be installed by a licensed installer if it's to be done now. In any event, somebody, either an assessor or more likely an appraiser or somebody in the context of a loan, if the bank were making a loan, would have to examine it to make sure that it is permanently affixed. I don't know that the bank would incur any liability, but certainly there would be no liability to the state.
I would assume that wherever there's a loan, there's a certain that's the type of liability I mean.
There would be no liability to the state. The Division of Motor Vehicles would be relying on the affidavit of affixation. There is no obligation on the Division of Motor Vehicles or any other Alaska agency actually to confirm to its own satisfaction that permanent affixation occurred correctly.
Thank you.
Now, the title insurance companies also have a say in that, but right. As far as the state goes, no.
Kind of connected to that question, if I could. I have two other questions here from Representative Grunberg and Representative Peterson. But the bill speaks of filing of the affidavit with the Department of Admin on page 17, line 31 and 19, line 26. And I believe we have a, you know, zero fiscal note, and I am assuming that it is because it's the role that the Department of Admin plays is providing a filing cabinet. Maybe the sponsor would like to comment to that. But I'm just looking at the engagement of the department in this process, and if they've had any input in that kind of thing.
Well, the department does more than put it in a filing cabinet. The department has to note in its records that filings have been made, that there are a number of things the department has to do, the division has to do, but my understanding is that the division is going to be charging fees for those things. What I can tell you, and Senator French knows this as well as anyone, this bill went through, I will be polite and say, excruciating negotiations with a whole variety of constituencies, including at great length the division. This is not the first version of the bill, and the bill has been changed to meet the division's satisfaction. So I can't speak for the division, except that I know that they signed off on the bill, and the contemplation is that they will be charging fees to the extent necessary to cover their additional costs.
Yeah. Thank you. I wouldn't have asked the question if I had read the fiscal note. Thank you. It says here this bill will have only a small financial impact on DMV. DMV will absorb any implementation costs in its operating budget. Representative Grunberg?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A couple of questions. Representative Seaton, may I ask your question?
Sure.
Okay. We have at least one other definition of manufactured home in Alaska statutes, and it's in AS 45.29.102, subsection 66, and that is in a chapter entitled Secured Transactions. It's not the UCC Secured Transactions provision. But it's in here. I wasn't familiar with it. And it's somewhat different, I think. I'm not sure. If the members would look at section 28 of the bill, which is on the last page, I'm totally backwards. This references that. So
yes, the whole idea, if I may say, that is in Article 9 of the Uniform Commercial Code.
Oh, it is.
And the idea of this bill, and there are a number of other provisions, for example, if I can draw your attention to page 2, toward the top, you'll see section 2 and so on. We have done our best in a number of instances to try and conform various definitions of manufactured home or real property to refer to manufactured home as defined in the section that you just mentioned.
So,
because otherwise, yes, it's all over the place.
That is
in the Uniform Commercial Code, and that is in Article 9. So we are attempting to try and conform these things as much as possible.
Representative Grunberg has a follow-up.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair, if I may dialogue for a second here. So I didn't realize, I see, what we had done at one time was have the secured transaction provision of the UCC was with the rest of the UCC, and then we repealed it and enacted this new provision.
In 2001.
And I wasn't here then. Okay. Well, this makes sense. I was wondering, and I'm sort of looking at Senator French, who's the chair of the Judiciary Committee over there in the Senate. I hadn't realized until now that we have a new secured transactions provision in the UCC that isn't with the rest of the UCC, because we repeal.
Well, actually, sir, actually, Representative, it is. What happened is that in 2001, a new version of Article 9 of the Uniform Commercial Code took effect in every state that adopted the new version, and as far as I know, every state in the country did, and Alaska was one of them. So the old Article 9 has, from that day forward, essentially been replaced by the new Article 9, of which this section is a part.
I can see that. We've just moved it, but for those of us who read the statutes for fun and profit, it's now in 4529 rather than 4509. Okay, that makes sense. And let me ask you, this looks like a very good bill and will affect favorably, I think, a number of my constituents. In Alaska, I think it's safe to say, and the folks on the committee, and Senator French and Representative Peterson can correct me, most people, at least in Anchorage, who have mobile homes, the vast majority don't own the underlying real estate. They are in mobile home parks. And so they will not be affected by this new law. I have a friend who does own the property under her mobile home, but most people just will not be able to take advantage of this. Am I correct, if they don't own the underlying real estate?
I can answer that. I can answer that. Yeah, the answer is yes. They will not be affected.
Thank you, though, Senator French. Mr. Chair, if I may.
Oh, I'm sorry, through the chair.
Is there anything in the works through the industry or anything that will allow folks who, you've had a 20-year lease provision in there, I hear, but I don't think these guys have a 20-year lease. I think the owners of mobile home parks generally want to keep kind of flexible so they can turn them into office buildings and stuff. I know in Senator French is, I think, in your district, in mine, they've demolished some mobile home parks, and they're either building nice condos or something like that, or in one case, an assisted living thing. Is there any way that we could, maybe in another piece of legislation or anything, make this sort of thing available to people who don't have 20-year leases and don't own the underlying property?
Senator French,
thank you. Through the chair, it may be possible, but that's not what this bill does, I'm afraid.
No, I understand that. I'm just actually asking, Mr. Ginsburg, is there any other legislation in any other state that accomplishes that? I don't mean with this.
Well, my knowledge, no. And the reason is, remember, that the idea is legally to convert personal property to real estate, and we're talking about people who don't own the real estate. They may own the home, but it's placed on real estate. First of all, most of the time they rent the home, but even if they own it, it's placed on real estate that's owned by somebody else and which they occupy, as you say, pursuant to a short-term lease. So I don't know how, frankly, you convert that to real estate. In fact, in a number of other states, we had to put in the legislation specifically that this does not apply to people who occupy homes in mobile home parks. In fact, if anything, the pressure was the other way, to make sure that those folks were not covered.
Thank you.
They're not, as Senator French said, in this bill.
Thank you both.
Representative Peterson.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I've got a couple of questions. The first one is, how often are the manufactured homes required to register with the DMV now?
Through the chair, I think you register it when it's brought to Alaska, and that's the end of it, just like your car. And then you pay taxes every year on personal property.
So it's a one-time deal. Okay. And do you know how much what the cost of that is?
Representative Peterson, we have Shelley on from DMV. If we could direct that, unless you have a response.
Better idea. Thank you.
Shelley, are you there?
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
Did you hear the question of Representative Peterson? If you did, identify yourself and ask, otherwise he will re-ask.
For the record, my name is Shelley Mawad. I'm the Deputy Director of the Division of Motor Vehicles. Through the Chair, Representative Peterson, the cost is $100, and it is a one-time title fee. We don't register mobile homes. We just title them.
Okay.
Thank you, Shelley.
One additional question.
Follow-up, Representative Peterson.
Thank you. This is a different question. And since we're going to be converting personal property to real property, what effect is this going to have on the insurance on these manufactured homes? Is it going to go up, going to go down, going to be easier to get insurance? Does anyone have any ideas on that?
Through the Chair, Representative Peterson, I don't know. That's a good question. I hadn't thought about it. Again, it's a voluntary process, so that would be something that the owner would do before he or she took these steps. I don't know that it would change the insurance, but it might. I don't know.
Well, Representative Peterson, my understanding, this is George Ginsburg again, is that the American Land Title Association has a model amendment to its policy that, as I understand it, would insure the manufactured home as real estate once something like this procedure were accomplished. And therefore, what we would be talking about here is, that's title insurance. With respect to homeowners insurance, that I don't know. I would assume, but I can't say, Pat Green, maybe you know, that once this process is concluded, that somebody may be able to get insurance not otherwise available, again, as if this were a stick-built home, but I'm beyond my pay grade when it comes to that one.
We have Representative Peterson, and then I wanted to. We're going to have Representative Seaton have a question, but we also have Patrick Green on from Wells Fargo, and at some point I would like to ask him. I would like to assume that the bank has the option of calling any certified inspectors or whatever, you know, to verify the whatever they're loaning money on. And the reason that has is related to your question is that if there was a permanently affixed manufactured home that maybe had a new furnace room with sheetrocked and whatever, you know, that it might help, you know, but it depends on the quality of the construction, that which would go back to the bank. I couldn't resist. I used to build homes. I started in a mobile home, too. $7,800 if it jumps in my mind, you know, on Boniface. Representative Seaton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I guess one of the questions we had asked was about standards and whether older ones would apply. And under the definition of manufactured home in 4529-102, it says that this required United States Secretary of Housing and Urban Development and complies with the standards established under 42 USC. So apparently there are some standards, and whether those standards are updated, you know, we would have to investigate further on that. But I guess from some of the things that we've talked about, I'm a little wondering whether we've talked about a lot of motorhomes or mobile homes that have lost the titles. So does this then allow for conversion of untitled mobile homes to be converted to real property? Because that's what I'm kind of hearing is the case. And also, the testifier was saying that it would really need a DMV database, and I wanted to know whether there a DMV database of that ownership is publicly searchable. Is that public information open to the public? Or whether we are needing something that whether that's available or not.
Yeah, the two questions there. We'll give Senator French first shot, and then Shelley, if you would maybe follow up.
I'll just go to Shelley.
Okay. Well, I can't help but on your first question again.
Was the conversion of untitled mobile homes, because that was the testimony, is a lot of people have lost those titles, and yet the purpose of this is allow conversion of those untitled properties to real property. And I just want to make sure.
There's a provision in the bill, but I'll let Shelley walk you through it, or Mr. Ginsburg.
Shelley?
Through the chair, Representative Seaton. There is a process to title and a motorhome if the title has been lost or not passed on through the owners, different owners. Basically, they would get a bond for the to prove ownership and to protect the state. So they would get a bond for 1.5 times the appraised value of it, and they would bring that bond to the state, and we would title it into their name based off that bond. At that point, we'd have to turn around and cancel the title if they had an asphyxiation affidavit, and then give them paperwork showing that title. It's been recorded, and the title's been canceled.
Thank you, Shelley. And then the second one was, are the databases going to be publicly searchable?
Currently, they're considered motor vehicles in our database, which are not public information.
Okay. Thank you. Representative Gruber. Oh, did you have a follow-up? I'm sorry.
Yes, I did. I think I heard from Wells Fargo, their outside counsels or whatever, that they needed that, or I think there was maybe an alternative. But if that is not publicly searchable, do we have a situation in which they're saying they need this publicly searchable database to be able to accomplish the purpose of the act, and currently it's non-publicly searchable? And maybe the lawyer from that was the outside counsel could come back, and that's what I thought I heard him testify to, but I could have been mistaken.
George, did you follow that question?
Yeah, yes, I am. Let me respond, Mr. Chairman. First of all, the bill does provide, if you go to page 8, and you'll see section 28.10.264, there's a slightly different procedure from the one that Shelley described. The bill provides that it's not necessary for someone who doesn't have a title to her home, either because it was never issued or it's lost or the person never got one or whatever, to apply for a bonded title and then surrender it. There is a provision in the bill whereby that person would apply to the department for what I will call a confirmation of conversion. It is required. A bond does have to be given. Shelley is absolutely correct. But basically, what it would provide is that the department, not that it would issue a title and then surrender it, and then have the consumer surrender it, but it would note on its records that an application has been accepted and that therefore its records would show that no, there's no certificate of title to this home because it has been converted to real property. So specifically, the bill does address a situation in which the consumer, the homeowner, does not have a title, but the home is permanently affixed, and it is converted to real estate without the necessity of getting a title. Although in that case, a bond is required just to protect other people who may have some kind of interest in the home. Again, the idea, and with respect to the second question, there are certain aspects, certain details, which would not be publicly searchable, but the fact that a home has been converted to real property by the procedure I just mentioned, or the fact that the certificate of origin, if there is one, has been surrendered, or the certificate of title has been surrendered, all, as far as I know, would be publicly searchable on the division's in the division's records. In fact, that's part of the whole idea of the bill, that you could look at both the division's records and the recorder's office and see whether, in fact, the home has been converted to real estate, so you don't have to guess.
Follow-up for presidency?
Thank you, and I just wanted to confirm with DMV that is available in the format, publicly searchable format that they're talking about, and that's not precluded by other statutes.
Shelley?
Through the chair, Representative Seaton, from my understanding, there's no provision to make that information publicly available. I mean, the information can be searchable, publicly searchable. The information can be given to the owner of record, who can then turn it over to whoever they would like to turn it over to, but it is not publicly searchable. We don't have that ability in our system.
Okay, and
follow-up, Representative Seaton?
And kind of melding those two, if we don't have an owner of record, they can do the bond and become the owner of record, and then you could supply that to the real estate issuer. Is that what you are telling me?
Through the chair, Representative Seaton, yes.
Thank you.
Okay. Representative Gruenberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Ginsburg, I'm going to ask a question that I asked before, but in a little different form. And let me tell you why I'm going to ask the question. Under Alaska law, if we adopt a law from another state, then we, as a matter of law, take that law with the interpretation put upon it by the highest court of record that has reviewed that law, like in California be the Court of Appeals generally, or might be the Supreme Court. But that's generally the rule. And that is decisions that have been rendered prior to the enactment of the law in Alaska. Decisions on the same law after the date of enactment in Alaska are not binding, but they're persuasive. And that's why I need to ask whether this law is taken from the law of any other jurisdiction, because that will make quite an important difference to any court that construes this in the future. And the bill does not go to the Judiciary Committee. So I need to know the genesis of this act.
This was, Senator Gruenberg, this was a bill that Wells Fargo and others have, whose basic language was successfully introduced and adopted in other states. But the only thing I can tell you specifically in the answer to your question, and Pat Green, perhaps you can speak up if I'm wrong here, but all of these bills are relatively new in the last several years. And while I haven't looked everywhere, I am unaware of any significant cases of the type that you would be talking about interpreting similar legislation like this in any state. So, again, off the top of my head, I am unaware of any decisions with which Alaska would be burdened. And certainly it's not a uniform law. There are differences. There are additions. There are deletions. There are some states, for example, in which the bill in introduced form does not have this confirmation of conversion procedure I mentioned, but does in fact require a bonded title that will then be surrendered. There are differences, but again, the bottom line is that we are talking about relatively recent bills, and I think that the idea of being burdened or bound by, or presumably bound by, decisions in other states is in the real world not an issue in connection with a bill like this.
May I please follow up?
Follow up, Representative Grunberg.
I'll accept that answer. Appreciate that. The second part of my question is, and I don't know if Wells Fargo or the banking industry has any ability to do this, to maybe get a list of the states that have similar or substantially similar laws that a court and lawyers construing this in the future would be able to look to for not binding precedent, but precedent. I see we have Senator French's hands up. Maybe he could answer that.
Senator French.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and through the chair to Representative Grunberg. I have in my hand a January 2009 document from the National Consumer Law Center about Manufactured Housing Resource Guide. It's the title of the document is Titling Homes as Real Property. It is quite extensive. It covers the dozens of states that currently have state conversion statutes. It gives you a synopsis of those statutes. They're not in full, but they're synopsized. I can make that available to you either now or in the near future.
Mr. Chair, you'll have to, maybe we can talk about this. I don't know how you want to do this, but assuming the bill passes and you send your file to the archives, that may be sufficient, or the reference to that document. It's just something to think about. It may never come up, and it may be just a road we don't need to go down. I'll have to think. I don't want to make a big deal about it. It sounds to me like there are lots of states that have this, and it's probably not that complex. But who knows? Thank you. I'll pass on. I don't have anything else.
Patrick, are you on the?
Yes, I am. Representative Keller, I think the only thing, this is Patrick Green with Wells Fargo. I think the only thing that I might add is that we Wells Fargo and the banking industry almost embarked on this legislative process for almost philanthropic purposes. Right now, this only affects borrowers who have their manufactured home on a permanent foundation and own the land underneath it, and right now we're only really able to give consideration when making a real estate loan on those people to the raw land, to the value of the raw land underneath it. And we'd like to be able to give consideration to a manufactured home on the real estate when it's on a permanent foundation as well. And this conversion process, a vast majority of other states have this conversion process in place, and it meets the guidelines of HUD and the government-sponsored entities, Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. It allows us to really just give financing to borrowers in this type of situation at a much reduced cost. So it's really a good piece of legislation. It really benefits, the banking industry and consumers alike.
Thank you. I have two questions.
Thank you.
Here. One is, I would assume, as with any real property, you will have this potential market. You'll be protecting your interests, and you'll have complete, authority to require authorized inspections, whatever is required in the community that the property is. But I'm just, I'm assuming that the consumer protections and your interest, make sure you're loaning on a good item and that kind of thing, are all the same as any other real property. Is that right?
Yes, most definitely. It would go through the normal appraisal process. When lending on this type of loan, we'd go through the normal appraisal process like any other home, and consideration would be given to the fact that, it's a manufactured home on a permanent foundation, and all the other items necessary to give a true, accurate value of the home and the piece of property.
The second question is a little subjective, but
Have we made the bill so complicated that not many will comply is my real question. But what I'm wondering, if you could describe the hoops that the buyer, the person that is doing this conversion has to go through. I mean, is it pretty, from your perspective, will it be an intensive one? I assume that because it's a market you're interested in, that you'd be providing the guidance and the help and the process and all that kind of thing. And can you give us a simplified explanation of that?
Yeah, most definitely. We would definitely guide the borrower through the entire process. What I would probably do is defer to George as far as the actual process itself and walking you through that process. I think he might best be able to answer that question.
Okay. Sure. First of all, before you go, we'll give George a chance, but before you go away, unless you had more than that, Representative Seaton had a question.
I had a question, and I'm not sure who it's for, but is this necessary for those manufactured homes to be able to qualify for either energy rebates or for the weatherization program of the state? And do you know, and whether if people go through this process to have this be not a mobile home, manufactured home, but actually be real estate, whether they would then qualify potentially for those programs?
Through the chair, Representative Seaton, I don't know the answer. Good question, but I don't believe this would have any material effect on the way situation exists today, right? If you understand my answer, that is, I don't know. That's the answer.
Yeah, for what it's worth, I would hope. It would.
Yeah. Well, I would too, but Mr. Chairman,
my guess is right now they're eligible. I mean, apartment houses are eligible that you don't own. Yeah. My apartment, I rent apartments. People in the apartments can go get energy rebates if they sign up for them. But most people don't want to make an investment in property they don't own. But it's different with a trailer house because you own the property but not the land underneath. But it's a good question. I don't know.
Thank you,
Chair. Representative Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and I was going back to the gentleman from Wells Fargo, and I imagine that if you're financing these manufactured homes, that there's some sort of insurance that would be required for the owner to carry, and so if this property is going to be converted from personal property to real property, what effect is that going to have on the insurance? Is it going to be more expensive, less expensive, or is... there's going to be more insurance companies willing to provide insurance in this situation? Is it going to have no effect at all, do you know?
Yes. Representative Seaton, through the chair, I'm not an insurance professional, but I think I can speak in generalities in the sense that, homeowner's insurance on real property is less than it is on a manufactured home, I think in general, being not an insurance professional, generally speaking, I think it would be lower homeowner's insurance.
Okay, thank you.
Seeing no further questions, thank you, gentlemen, very much. I don't think there's anybody in the room to testify. At least I don't have anything. So we're going to close public testimony. It's back to the committee. Yes.
May I just say one more thing about the searchability of the records, because I know that was an issue.
Is this Patrick?
Ginsburg.
George, if you would identify yourself again, it's just for the record.
I'm sorry.
Yeah.
This is George Ginsburg. I apologize. I know that there were questions about the searchability of the records, particularly in the division. If I could direct the committee for a second to look at page 4 of the bill.
Well, hold on, if you would. I close public testimony, George, and I.
Oh, I'm sorry.
I'm not trying to cut you out. I just need to just open it back up. So public testimony is open. Please proceed.
Okay, thank you. If I could direct the committee to look at page 4 of the bill, section 8. Says the Department of Administration shall file, maintain, and appropriately index records of, and then you can see the variety of things from 6 to 11 that the bill adds. And again, the whole point of the bill is that if I'm a prospective purchaser or I'm a prospective lender, I will be able to look at the division's records and see if, in fact, there was a cancellation of the certificate of title or a confirmation of conversion. And the division's records would indicate, yes, there was, and there would be an affidavit of affixation filed with the recorder's office. And from those things, I could get comfort that this item is now real estate that I can purchase by a deed or finance by a mortgage. So the bill does contemplate that at least the fact of confirmation or surrender will be on the division's records and indexed.
For what it's worth, I would presume that DMV is aware of that and has called it, what do I say here, a small financial impact to the DMV, and it says that, you know, the regulations are future on this, so I think that that will be worked out, and public testimony is open, Shelley, so if you want to contradict that, please do.
Mr. Chairman, this is Shelley Malott from Division of Motor Vehicles. The DMV records by statute are not public records. The bill does on page 11, lines 6 through 9, point out that we will not only give an acknowledgement of the title surrender to the applicant, but also they have the ability to give us the name and address of one other person for us to send that to. Outside of that, like I said, under statutes, DMV records aren't public. They can go through the recorder's office, I assume, to get that information. That has been converted.
Representative Seaton has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. That was the intent of my earlier question, to make sure we weren't having an unintended consequence of all of a sudden making all of the DMV records open to the public when previously they have not been. So I think that the clarification by DMV should serve that we are not making those public records, that the way a title insurance or other company would have to go through, it would be through the applicant asking for the information and requesting that to be sent to one other person. So I just want to make sure that it's very clear on the record that we are not modifying the general DMV statute to say that those are all now public records. So thank you very much for that, Mr. Chairman.
Good point. Representative Goonberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like the members to take a look at Section 7 of the bill, and Senator French and Mr. Ginsburg also. This is it's on page 4 of the bill, lines 14 to 19. It's a little bit unusual, not unusual, it's a standalone, not a standalone, it deals with a different title. And I'm kind of directing this a little bit to Senator French and Mr. Ginsburg. What this references is in the Code of Civil Procedure, a chapter entitled, quote, Actions Relating to Real Property. And what this Section 7 does, for the first time it provides a definitional section in a new article to that. And it talks about the definition of manufactured home and the definition of real property. And this is kind of a complex question and probably may not be able to be answered in this bill. But at some point, I'm wondering if somebody has taken a look at Chapter 45 of Title 9 to see if there would have to be any other conforming amendments to anything in there, because that deals with quiet title, forcible entry, foreclosure of liens, nuisances, participation, recovery of possession, trespass, waste, etc. And since that has dealt with the traditional types of real property, and now we're going to be at least potentially converting one type of personal property to real property, whether as a practical matter, maybe over the interim or something, Ledge Legal should triple check and see if there should be any conforming amendments to ASO 9.45 to make certain that there are no unintended consequences. This is the last week of the session, Mr. Ginsburg. I'd like to see this bill pass. I don't want to hold it up, but I'm sort of suggesting to Senator French, and I'm happy to help on the interim with that too if I can, but just maybe ask Ledge Legal to triple check and make certain that there doesn't have to be anything conforming. I don't have anything more than that.
Senator French?
Chair to Senator French.
Thank you. Through the chair, Representative Grunberg, I don't want to make any promises I can't keep, and so I would certainly be happy to ask Ledge Legal to do that.
Yeah.
But I wouldn't want to pledge my resources to it, because I just wouldn't want to mislead the committee. I guess I would point to the strong letters of support we have from the title industry itself, including First American Title, the Alaska Land Title Association, and so forth. These professionals, having reviewed the bill, support it, and so that gives me some comfort that we're not disrupting the commercial world through the passage of this bill.
Through the chair. No, I wasn't suggesting you or anything. It was just a question of whether Ledge Legal might take a look. I don't want to do more work. That's probably a lot of work. And no, I wasn't suggesting you or me do that.
Does the committee have any more questions for the banker or the DMV or the law firm? Representative Pierce?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just one more. I was just thinking about a homeowner trying to get a clean title to their motorhome, because some of these may have been around the state for quite some time, and the records may be difficult to ascertain. And so there is a process set up in this bill, I believe, that allows the homeowner, if he can't get a clear title, to provide a bond. Is that the reason that bond's available in this bill? Is because in some instances it may be difficult to go back and get the entire history of who all has owned a particular motorhome?
Were you directing that question to Mr. Ginsburg?
Yes.
Mr. Ginsburg or Senator French, whoever might be able to answer that.
There are two different issues here, and I will defer to Shelley on the second one. The first one is the bill provides for a bond, not for the purpose of obtaining a title to the home, but for the purpose of converting the home to real property in the event there is no title. And the bond basically is designed to protect anybody who may come along for a certain period of time and said, wait a minute, I have an interest in this home, I have a security interest in it, I have a lien on it, I have some kind of document that says I own a certain percentage of it. That's what the bond is designed to do for purposes of the bill. Now, I believe, but I defer to Shelley on this one, that if somebody doesn't have a title and wants a title, that there is a procedure in Alaska law to get a title by posting a bond, but that's a different issue.
Shelley, did you have a follow-up?
Through the chair, Representative Peterson. Yes, that you can't, when you don't have proper ownership documents of a vehicle or a mobile home or There is a process, a bonding process, that a person can go through to have a title issued in their name. So.
Okay. Thank you.
I see a satisfied committee, I think. So we're going to try closing public testimony again. Oh, I'm sorry.
I move that we move the CS for Senate Bill number 104, Judiciary Version E, out of committee with individual recommendations and accompanying fiscal notes.
Seeing no objections, the bill moves, and it's 9:36. Meeting adjourned to next schedule, by the way. First, the next schedule is not set up firm yet, so it's still impending. So we're adjourned.